Hi, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the Lean Pub Podcast, where I'm going to be interviewing author Yevgen Nebisov, based in Bruxelles. Yevgen is an independent systems architect, consultant, and speaker with more than 10 years of experience across transport, logistics, and medical technology. His work focuses on socio-technical complexity, how technical decisions, organizational structures, and human behavior shape one another. Yevgen is the author of the Lean Pub book, The Architecture of Power, See What Shapes Outcomes, Find Where You Can Act. The book asks the question, why do unwanted outcomes keep returning even after people, policies, or priorities change? And we're going to go into depth about the kind of theory and practice behind that. The book is split into two parts that roughly kind of map to that. It's a very fascinating book. In this interview, we're going to begin by talking a little bit about Yevgen's background and career. Then we'll talk about the book, and then we'll talk about his experience as a speaker and writer and things like that. So Yevgen, thank you so much for being on this episode of the Lean Pub Podcast.
Yeah, hi, Lynn. Thanks.
I always like to start these interviews by asking people to talk about themselves and their origin story. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about where you grew up and how you found your way to Germany and into a career as a systems architect.
Okay, yeah, it's obviously a long way. I am originally from Kharkiv in Ukraine, where I grew up. And at the age of 18, I moved to Germany, where I live now for more than a half of my life. And I studied mathematics, informatics in Hannover. And after the university, I started working as a software engineer. And over time, I became lead engineer and then architect, lead architect, technical project lead, and executed roles like this. And yeah, this is I spent last 15 years or so working in software projects, both in regulated environments such as medical devices and defense, as well as less regulated ones such as transportation, retail, and logistics.
One thing that comes up often, a lot of Lean Pub authors are people who move around a lot. I've moved around a lot in my life. And so I'd just like to ask a question. What was it like moving from, you know, Kharkiv to Germany? Was there a big culture shock for you? You were 18 years old. You know, was it seamless?
Oh, it was a lot of stress for me because it was an age where you have your friends and so on, and then suddenly you lose everything and to build it again from zero. But later on, I don't know, integrated in the German society, and now I see myself as a German.
Okay. Oh, and did you speak German when you moved there?
No, I learned it. I learned it here.
Okay. And so you went from studying math in university to being a systems architect. Did you, what, how, what was that? What was that path like? Did you do more training, or did you just kind of learn on your own?
Actually, not at all. It was more or less linear progression from software designer, I don't know, lead programmer, and
okay.
then architect. I read books and articles and watched talks all the time. This was
okay.
There were no big jumps in my roles.
Okay. And so for people watching or listening, can you talk a little bit about what a systems architect is and does?
Yeah, basically in software projects, you had previously people who write code. Today, everyone writes code. But in principle, before you write code, you need to do some analytical work, like how do we translate the business requirements into the structure of our application, how we split the system into the components, how we define interfaces between them, which functionality goes in one component, which goes in another one. This is the work that a software or systems architect does in collaboration with business, with stakeholders, and with people responsible for the delivery. So it's more or less a glue role of the project that glues all other roles together.
Okay. And so is the way it would, I'm just sort of curious about the sort of, you know, working life of a systems architect. So does someone do the kind of notorious tap you on the shoulder? Do you have 5 minutes and the next 6 months of your life is on a new project that kind of came down from on high? Or do you get to, do you, if you're working at a big company, say, or do you get to pick projects that you're working on?
I usually work for 1 or 2 years in one project. And always just, I had sometimes two projects in parallel, but it's usually just one.
Okay, and would you be there typically, would a systems architect typically be there from the very beginning? Like, you know, like some decision has been made to do something and you're brought on board to design?
It depends on the company. A
Okay.
startup doesn't have any
No.
systems architect. They just do things. Yeah. But in a very regulated environment, for example, in the defense, you have systems architecture as one of the mainstreams, and you need to deliver some software architecture artifacts before you start coding. There are some quality gates that you cannot jump over. And that's why in this project, software architects, also systems architects, join even before the first developers start.
Oh, that's really fascinating. Particularly in regulated environments, I know that, you know, there can be all kinds of,
Well,
there's actually all kinds of structure that
it's
exists.
not fascinating.
No, well, I mean, but, well, I mean, yeah,
It's
I know, but from a certain
very
ex perspective, it's kind of like, oh, there's like actually like, you know, from the startup perspective, it's just like, go do it. But
bureaucratic.
moving in, starting in something where there's already structure that exists and that needs to be kind of abided by along the way is actually an interesting challenge. Especially because also regulations can change, as we all know, along the way, or new regulation can be introduced. One question I wanted to ask you was, you know, one cannot do an interview these days without bringing up AI. And so when did AI first start, like what we're calling AI, just the loose way we use the term now, when did that first enter into your work? Was it, you know, a year and a half ago, like it was for startups? Was it 5 years ago?
So if we consider under AI LLMs like ChatGPT and Upwork, yeah, then I started using ChatGPT. I forgot when it came, end of 2022, something like
That
that.
sounds right, yeah.
And yeah, but I was not a power user at the beginning, just translating some texts and writing emails. But over time, I used it more and more. And today, of course, I use it almost the entire day.
Yeah, it's very, I would imagine it's very, you know, in addition to the sort of use we all kind of make of it, asking questions and stuff like that. I imagine I'm just kind of interested from the perspective of someone who's designing a system, the kind of non-deterministic feature of having LLMs involved in the things. It's funny because I've talked to some people who are like, oh, you know, as a programmer, you know, dealing with something non-deterministic is, you know, totally unfamiliar to me, and I had to learn that. And other people are like, yeah, people are non-deterministic, and so are lots of other things. And so, kind of fundamentally, it's kind of like, you know, not actually that new a thing with respect to being non-deterministic.
And one of the drivers for my book was exactly the fact that we have now AI with the capability of human level intelligence, which means intelligence becomes a commodity more or less in certain disciplines more and certain less. But the I was for the last 15 years, I was basically intelligence trader. I exchanged my knowledge and experience against money, and many people or everyone in my industry does the same. But now this intelligence becomes commodity, and the question is what is still human? And my answer to this question is agency. So the ability to change things not in software, but in peopleware. And this is what is still human, I would say. And this was my reason to work on this project. Like, okay, we lost intelligence to AI. We lost dexterity and strength to robots. What is still ours? And this is the agency. And my book is exactly about this. About
So
this sort of reality.
this might be jumping ahead ahead too much. But it's very interesting, this idea of, like, because people will talk about, like having a human in the loop, things like that. Particularly, I only know this, what I'm about to mention, from podcasts and stuff like that and reading the news. But military weaponry, keeping a human in the loop is something that's actually very important for people. And it's very interesting because there are conflicting views on that, right? Like, there are people who are like, well, we've already had systems that can react incredibly quickly to circumstances for a long time. Once you drop an old-fashioned bomb, it's autonomous. It might have, like, a some kind of, gyroscope or something in like that in it, or something more complicated. But the one of the thing about having a human is that a human can actually be rewarded and punished, basically, in a way that machines kind of can't be. Do you think that's it's the reward and punishment that is the remainder of human agency within systems? I'm bringing this up, by the way. This is for anyone listening. These are my words, not yours.
Well, I think it's connected. It motivates. It mediates human behavior, of course. But we are, of course, carriers of trust, and this is, I think, what makes up our agency. For example, if I trust you and you recommend me some book, I will probably read it in comparison if some algorithm recommends me this book as an example. And this is our ability, using our trust as a carrier, to change behavior of people around us. I mean, not in a manipulative way, but to structurally change outcomes around us. Maybe as an example, imagine we are in the year 2050 and we want to build a bridge. We don't need an architect anymore because AI can design a bridge perfectly. We don't need contractors anymore because we can source all the materials via self-driving cars to our construction site. And the robots can build the bridge for us, so we don't need any people at all, we would say. But do we have the bridge now? No, because there are still some stakeholders, like people we have to convince to provide financing. We need to build a road that affects many buildings, and there are many stakeholders, and we have to bring them up to the idea and create a coalition of people supporting this cause, this idea. So there is a lot of political work to do. And this is this third modality where we still need agency, human agency to operate. So the first one, the architect, was the intelligence. The second one, the building, was dexterity and strength, which is now will be taken over by robots more and more. And the third one is a human agency where we operate not on the software, not on the hardware, but on peopleware.
Okay, thank you very much for that great explanation and that great example. So with that stage set, let's kind of go back a few steps and let's start talking about your book. And I think what you just said will make a lot more sense when we get to the end of the discussion. Not that it didn't make sense, but the technical terms that you were using. The book is The Architecture of Power. And you start with this great question, which is, why do unwanted outcomes keep returning after people, policies, or priorities change? And one thing that's great I love about that question is, when you talk about, you say unwanted outcomes, you can mean in a relationship, a personal relationship. It could mean a company. It could mean a software project. It could mean anything. And it's very, very deliberate, the way that the level of kind of generality that the question is asked. So, why do unwanted outcomes keep returning, even after people, policies, or priorities change?
Because in my opinion, the outcomes are not a property of people or certain policies or rules. They are emergent properties of an entire arrangement consisting of people, consisting of rules, consisting of roles, of people beliefs, of some rituals, of public agendas, and all of that constitutes some arrangements that reproduce outcomes. And of course, we can change a couple of nodes in these arrangements, but if those arrangements are stable and dense, they will for sure reproduce what was before. And yes, my goal was to understand these arrangements. What are the nodes in these arrangements? What are the relations between them, and how they keep outcomes reproducing? And of course, how to change those arrangements, even if you don't have any full control around them. If you only if you can reach a couple of nodes in them, how do you propagate your agency, your course throughout these arrangements?
Okay. So let's start then by talking about the power loop. Can you talk? And you, by the way, there's a great website accompanying all of this that sort of walks you through things step by step, and it's really good with practical examples and kind of things you can do to test this out. So can you talk a little bit to begin with about the power loop?
Yes, the power loop is a central model of the book, and it explains power as a flow over six domains. I call it domains. The first domain is our beliefs. It is how we see, perceive, interpret the world, what things we keep as real, what we treat as a knowledge, what we treat as a what we consider normal, what we think are the things worth pursuing, so aiming for, and how do we identify ourselves in this world. These are beliefs, the first domain. The next domain is the institutions. In the power loop, the institutions are a triple of rules, roles, and rituals. Rules is basically any policies, any rules, any protocols that we have. It could be in an organization, it could be informal rules in a family, like who is bringing kids to the school. Then we have roles like software engineer or a parent or a student, and we have rituals. For example, a daily or weekly or even in routine of the in the family, these are rituals. And beliefs and institutions, they affect each other. The beliefs enable the establishment of institutions and make them legible, and institutions through the rituals, through the rules, exposure, they reproduce our beliefs. And of course, if there is a non-congruence between beliefs and institutions, if people don't believe in the institutions become brittle. They can survive on coercion for some time, but
Right.
if there is no natural congruence between them, that's just a matter of time until either the beliefs become congruent, or the institution becomes disrupted. Then institutions operate agendas. Agendas are arenas of the public attention of the public salience. So this is about which issues are we talking about? What concerns do we want to solve? For example, a government is an institution and it has an agenda. Every government session has a list of topics it discusses today. This is the agenda, the third domain. And on the agenda, the topics are being filtered, they're being framed, and only afterwards they reach the next domain, decisions. So this is where we discuss points. And many people associate power with the ability to make decisions, but in fact, decisions are very boring because what reaches a phase of decision was already filtered and framed on the agenda stage, or in the agenda domain, and the agenda was operated by the institution, which has also its structural bias, and the institution is based on belief. So basically, controlling decision is just controlling a tip of an iceberg. There is much more below it. But decisions create commitments that set actions in motion and flow into the next domain, which is events. So events are basically things that happen or not happen, provided the fact that they were registered. For example, if I don't know, if it was rain, it is an event. If it wasn't rain, then it's event if someone registered that it wasn't raining. Or if a company hired 50 employees, this is an event. But if it fired, for example, 50 employees and no one noticed it, then it is an occurrence, but it is not a political event in the sense of the framework, because the things that wasn't registered doesn't count for the political reasons. Important thing in the domain of beliefs is that they don't interpret themselves. This is just raw materials for the next domain, which is the narratives. And in the domain of narratives, we pick some events and connect them into the stories. And we use these stories in according to this model for two reasons: either to mediate our beliefs, to shape them, or to bring points onto agendas. For example, we observe that the climate has changed. We track events like everyday temperature. These are our events. And we connect them into the narrative. Oh, guys, look, there is global warming. And this causes a lot of suffering. And we use this narrative to bring this issue onto the agenda. And then again, if it's placed on the agenda and if it's prioritized, there will be decisions or no decisions. Again, new events, new narratives. With narratives, we can mediate our beliefs. Beliefs go in institutions, or we use narratives to mediate agendas. And this is how power flows throughout the loop and keep some things sedimented in institutions and beliefs. And these sedimented things are basically then the arrangements that keeps outcomes reproduced if these arrangements are stable.
So that's a fascinating system that you've presented.
I was very fast. I hope it was more or less understandable.
It was. I mean, that was very clear. I mean, I've for my sins, I've read a lot of philosophy, and so that opened up. There was sort of lots of things that were being set off in my brain there. But I really appreciate the structure of it. I guess one question then, and this might be a hard or an easy question then. So you, and this is the name of your first chapter, which is "What is Power?" But so within this structure, what is power? I mean, is it, does power, is self-awareness a feature of power, for example, or is this kind of like essentially a kind of force that drops out of an existing structure that's kind of, does it have a telos? Does power have an end in this conception of it, or can it?
Ooh, it's a hard question, and in the book I deliberately, even in the chapter "What is Power," I intentionally write that there will be no definition of power because there are like 100 definitions, and all of them are bad in the
Okay.
sense that
Yeah, no, that's a
there is
smart answer. Yeah.
because they are not universal. They define some aspect of phenomenology of power, but don't define other one, which makes it a contested concept. And it is one of the things that we all intuitively understand but cannot define. But the definition I like, or expression about power, is saying that power to society is what energy is to physics, and
Oh, sorry, can you
which
say that
means
again?
power to society is what energy is to physics.
Okay.
So it is driver of the relations of change and change in the physics of society.
Okay. That's a very good answer. I'm gonna have to chew on that one for a
Okay.
while.
But
One
that's
interesting thing that your description of the power loop there made me think about was the concept of arbitrariness, particularly in politics. So one of the origins of kind of contemporary democracy came not accidentally after the Enlightenment, when reason became an important feature of the way kind of people thought about how things should work. And one thing that if you see, read like Thomas Paine and other kind of revolutionary leadership figures would complain about when it came to monarchy or aristocracy was arbitrariness. That the monarch could just decide something. And then now what you would say is obviously the monarch can decide whatever they want without a system around them. It wouldn't matter of beliefs and loyalties and stuff like that. But what really bothered the kind of like burgeoning kind of notion of people who wanted democracy was they wanted there to be sense to things. And that required at some level an explanation that made sense of why things were happening, why things were going the way they were. And I guess in your definition, in your discussion of power, is there kind of like a layer where it's important for things to be explained and understood by the people within it? Or does that kind of not necessarily matter? Can someone just kind of happily go about not knowing or caring why they're doing what they're doing, but they're just, getting their paycheck or their satisfaction out of it?
So the first of all, the framework intentionally refrains from morality. It's not immoral in the sense that it's aimed to do bad things. It just takes morality out of equation. So in that sense, saying there is monarchy or democracy, there are just different forms of institutions. But the phenomenology of the power loop would be probably accurate in both cases.
Okay.
But to the second question, I think it is about the goal to change the architecture from monarchy to democracy, and the question is do we need to explain it to the stakeholders? And this is my answer is yes, because this is where we step into the narratives, where we start cultivating the beliefs. Narratives impact beliefs, and beliefs are the precursor of new institutions. And we need narratives to hijack the agenda of old institutions with new points that destroy institutions, not in the negative sense,
Yeah, I understand.
meaning just we need to disrupt old institutions and bring new ones. And we need to do two things. We need to prepare people for the new institutions, and we need to destroy the modus operandi of the old one once by bringing new points on the agenda.
So essentially, a narrative is necessary to bring about a revolution through changed beliefs about the way the institution should work. Would that kind of make sense?
I think yes, it of course the question is always what is the institution, and in many cases the thing we so the framework doesn't say institution is something like government. It could be something informal like everything what is repeating over and over again is in my definition is an institution. If it has some recognizable rules, roles, and rituals, then it's an institution. It could be a family is an institution. And the question is always what is the scope of that things that we want to change through our revolution or evolution or whatever. And of course, if we call this thing an institution, then according to the framework, yes, we need to feed new narratives into the beliefs of people so that they to build this incongruence between the beliefs and the institution.
So with a little bit of a theoretical framework now, the power loop, can you talk about power mapping now that we're kind of, armed with these ideas? What do we next do with them?
Basically, the end goal is to understand how to change power arrangements around us. For example, how to replace monarchy by a democracy. And before we start, we need to map the current situation. And I was thinking a lot, okay, how do we map power? And basically, because there was already a power loop with its six domains, And every domain has its own substructures, like five types of beliefs, three pillars of institutions, roles, rules, and rituals, and there are four dimensions of agendas. So every domain is split into subdomains. Why not using this structure to map the power arrangement? Basically, by going through every domain and subdomain and asking a question, okay, what's happening there? What are our rules? What are our roles? What are our rituals? What are our beliefs about? There are five types of beliefs. What are our beliefs of type one, two, three, and four, and five? What are our things about? What is getting admitted on the agenda? What is getting priority on the agenda? So, and the idea was to take the power loop, the six domains of the power loop, and which are dynamic. They're about dynamic flow, but make a static snapshot of the current state of the loop by bring them onto the canvas with six fields, six domains, and answering the question about every substructure of the power loop and see what happens there right now. So it's always snapshot because power is on always in the flow.
And so to make this kind of concrete, one thing you talk about on your one example you give on your website, and I'm looking at this one right now, is luxury as a power landscape. And I don't mean to put you too much on the hook for something. I don't know how long ago you wrote it. But it's interesting. I brought up kind of government and revolution, but one of the examples you give is luxury handbags. And how do you make an extraordinary price intelligible? And so I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about that. I mean, one thing you say is, for example, from a certain perspective, a cheap handbag and an expensive handbag, both in a sort of everyday carrying things around sense, perform the same function. But an everyday handbag and a luxury handbag are obviously very different things to people who conceive of them. Just one little anecdote that I before I ask you to sort of go through the example, a friend of mine was working on a doctorate a few years ago in political philosophy, and he was working on Isaiah Berlin, and his supervisor was like friends of the Berlin family, I think it was something like this, and he, as a gift, received Isaiah Berlin's book bag. So he had Isaiah Berlin's one. I mean, Isaiah Berlin probably had more than one book bag in his life, but he had one of Isaiah Berlin's book bags. And we were, he came, I was having a birthday party at a bar in London, and he showed up with his book bag, put it down beside him, and it was a very busy, popular bar. And about 10 minutes later, he looked down and his book bag was gone. Someone had stolen it, probably hoping there was a laptop in it or something like that. And my friend took it like a philosopher. But the sort of interesting thing about that experience was that went from being Isaiah Berlin's book bag to just being a book bag that was probably tossed. The guy probably, whoever stole it, probably looked inside, didn't find a laptop, and threw it in a bin. And that was it. No, anyone who found it might have been, oh, neat book bag or something like that. But I guess I wanted to just tell that story because your example of the book bag and the luxury book bag and what makes it a luxury book bag just brought that story to mind. It's an interesting
But it is
story of
actually
value.
this it's actually the same example which highlights that the value of the bag is not in the bag itself, but in what people think about this bag. In your case, for your friend, this book bag was special because Isaiah Berlin used it, and this was of high value. For someone else, it was just a bag, empty bag probably. And the question of the world of luxury is how we create the entire arrangement of power that make people believe that this certain object is loaded with value. So when, which means that when I buy a Gucci bag, I don't buy a Gucci bag, but if I would buy a Gucci bag, I'm not buying the bag. I'm buying the effort the Gucci invested in making everyone around me believe that this bag has value. So it's preloads this object with value by cultivating the belief that this is something. And of course, if I go to Himalaya, This bag has no value at all. And my goal was to understand how this entire arrangement of believing in the value of this bag is being reproduced. What are the institutions behind this? What are the beliefs? What are the narratives used? What are the topics on the agenda? What are the decisions usually being made? And what are the events? And I went through the entire canvas, through all these six domains, and mapped what is happening there.
Yes, and you talk about
Start.
specifically about what you call it landscape mapping, and I'm looking at run right here. You know, decisions, events, agendas, narratives, institutions, and beliefs, and so the six sort of dimensions that you were talking about before. And it actually is. I'm just for people who you know are listening or watching. You actually do map these things out, like you know, as it were, on paper or on a screen, and sort of
Canvas here.
and the canvas, and you fill it out. And one thing that I just found kind of like very engaging when I was, you know, going through the book and the website is the most important thing I think to begin with is to define what the outcome or the outcomes are for you. Is that right? Before you can do this kind of power analysis, you have to kind of decide what matters to you in the analysis
Exactly,
that you're
yeah.
doing.
For example, you work in a project. So my particular case has always been I'm working as a systems architect, and my concerns are the quality of the things we create, because the quality is crucial for the long-term success of the project. And for example, I don't like the outcomes being reproduced in the project that the project always decides too quick and dirty against putting effort in
Right.
qualitative work. And so this is the outcome I want to change. I define the thing that I don't like, and I would try to build a canvas explaining how this has been reproduced, and then define my goal outcome, like we do a qualitative work as a goal, and then thinking how to move the current landscape in small steps towards the landscape that will reproduce great outcomes that I want.
One perhaps kind of I don't know difficult question perhaps about I would have about this is how explicit I mean I guess it would depend on the circumstance but how explicit should one be let's say in a company about one's actual outcomes that one is driving at so for example a kind of classic kind of problem with changing systems from within is you may have an enemy. You may have an opponent, someone who wants you to fail. Just because that for no reason, maybe even. They just don't like you. Or there could be it could be a competitive environment where, you know, like there's two people at this level and there's only one person at the level above them. And if both people want to get there, they might, you know, try and in addition to trying to get there themselves, they might try to prevent the other person from getting there. So I'm just curious if kind of concealment or when you know when one's doing one landscapes mapping, one might not want to let everyone know what everything that you're mapping. Do you know
I
what I
think,
mean? Like, yeah.
I see. I think it's all already very tactical. The framework is more about structural changes, and the question how to jump from one
Right.
state to another one could be depends on the current situation. But what So in certain situations, of course, we need to keep silence and just move silently through the night, and in other just to prevent political friction from happening. And in other cases, we need to explicitly state the goal
Right.
to mobilize coalition on our side. It depends on the particular situation. But what I explicitly differentiate in the book in Part two, I think there is already a chapter on it being published, is the difference between structural tactics and activation tactics. The structural tactics are about what exactly do we want to change. For example, we want to build something, we want to change something in the institution, in the rules, or in the agendas, some structural change in one of the six domains. And another dimension is activation. It is about which participation from our people, from other people, we need to achieve the structural change. For example, in some cases, I want just people starting using the frame that I introduced. For example, the project don't pay much attention to the quality, and I start using the term technical debt.
Right.
And because it's debt, it is already some, it has some emotional connotation. What I need from other people in the first stage is just use this term. As it is one form of participation. So this one dimension is just how do I activate people, and another dimension is what for I activate them. And every structural tactics has different forms of activation it needs. For example, if I want to introduce a new ritual that will it is a part of institution, I need other people to act. They need to join this ritual, for example. Or if I want them to introduce a new term, then it would be adopt a new another form of activation.
Yeah,
So
I'm.
back
Yeah.
to your question, conceal or explicitly state. Explicitly state would be a form of activation to mobilize other people for your structural move.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, now we're moving on to the second part of the book where you do set out the tactics, kind of, activation tactics, event tactics, and the one that jumped out at me is a narrative tactics. That sounds like we're surrounded by narrative tactics in our lives, I think. Can you talk a little bit about what narrative tactics are in the context of the lead architect project that you talk about?
Okay. So in the power loop, the narratives are about creating some stories that can help move agendas, bringing some points on agendas, or changing the beliefs. And they do so by selecting certain events and putting them in causal form. There are, of course, different tactics what we can do. We can highlight certain events, we can select a subset of events that help our point and so on. These are all different tactics. And of course, if I want, for example, if I want to achieve in a project that we pay more attention to the quality, I cannot start with narratives. I always need some events because events are the fuel. They're the data for the narratives. So first thing that I need to do is to start tracing problems that are created by the old outcomes, like starting a log of delays of cases of the system being not available due to the technical problems and so on. So I need a body of evidence that I can use later. And then in the narrative domain, I would go on and pick some things from this body of evidence and construct a story that will help me advance my cause by linking these events to some outcome, to some structure that I don't want anymore. For example, these five negative events, for these five system crashes happened because 2 years ago we made this decision, and I want to use this evidence to reverse this decision. This is the mechanics behind this tactics.
And you give some structure to the narrative tactics side, which is quite fascinating. The narrative jobs of name, explain, assign, project, and anchor. And I wanted to go in a little bit of that, as much detail as you'd like to about that.
As I said, I introduced in the domain of beliefs, so the next domain behind narratives, five types of beliefs. And these five verbs in the narratives, they actually map to these five types of beliefs.
Okay.
The first, so these five types of narratives, they are designed to change or operate in one of this belief types. We
Okay.
have ontological beliefs. It is about what things do exist. For example, you're from Canada, right? I would say Canada doesn't exist in reality. It only exists because 8 billion people think it exists. If, for example, all of them lose memory for one day and wake up tomorrow, what is Canada? Never heard, right? So this is our ontological beliefs about what exists, and there are lots of conflicts about naming things.
Right.
Like the most recent one is how it's called, Lake of Ontario or Lake
Yeah.
of of
Lake
Trump. So
America, yeah.
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 So it's there are lots of conflicts just about giving things names. And this is there is a category of narratives that are designed to affect exactly this type of beliefs, to just to name things like there is no such thing as burnout. We constructed this concept, or toxic masculinity, that our DNA doesn't know this concept. It's purely constructed. Or Germany, it's an human invention. It doesn't exist. So all these things are narratives that someone constructed.
Yeah, chi childhood is an example I always like to give when I'm trying to explain that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the next type of beliefs, I would say, are epistemic beliefs. It is about what is true, which sources do we consider as true, which methods of gaining evidence we consider as satisfying to establish what is true and what is not. So it is about the first is about which things are exist, and when we have this atoms on which we can construct knowledge, we go into the epistemic beliefs where we say this is true, like Canada exists or Canada doesn't exist, or Canada is large, but
Right.
I
Okay.
cannot argue about Canada if Canada doesn't exist. So this
Yeah.
the ontological
Yeah.
beliefs, they fit all other
Okay.
beliefs, and there are the narratives. I forgot again how they are called.
Yeah, no, so name, explain, and the next one was a sign.
Exactly, explain. Yeah, so explain
Epistemology,
narrative.
yeah.
They go into epistemology, and then we have social order beliefs. It is about what is expected behavior, what is normal, what is not normal, and what other what people deserve respect. What is bad? And so on, and so on. So they basically regulate our us as a society, and there are narratives designed to mediate these beliefs, like saying this is good, this is bad. All these beliefs are what was it? You know my book better than me. I forget.
Well, I've got it right in front of me. But yeah, so name ontology, explain epistemology, assign society or
Assign, yeah, thank
social,
you.
yeah. And then the next one is project.
Exactly. Project is about next type of beliefs. It's the teleological beliefs.
Right. Okay.
Teleological beliefs are about goals, what we believe we want to achieve, what are the sacrifice we accept to pay, and so on. So basically, when the project lead says our goal is to deliver this project by the end of the year, this is he's setting the teleological beliefs by the narrative.
Okay.
And finally,
Yeah.
maybe the most important type of beliefs are identity beliefs. It is about who we are, who they are, who I am, and so on. And there are narratives that cultivate such beliefs. For example, we are a team that is responsible for for good quality. We are a nation that, I don't know, always keeps our streets clean. So this is basically our understanding about us and about them, whatever they are. And there are, of course, many narratives today that address those beliefs. They anchor our identities.
So the term for that narrative tactic mapping is anchoring, and that's I now understand mapping onto the belief about identity, which makes a lot of sense. And that's very well chosen. Those are two very well chosen words, I think, to map to each other. I guess you've kind of already made it clear that on a certain level, you don't believe that these things are kind of real, right? Like for example, like in the way that like a lot of people would just take it for granted that of course Canada exists, but in the common sense, you actually would just claim that Canada doesn't exist.
Depends on the definition of exist
Yeah, I
and
know.
or not exist. Yeah,
Yeah.
I would say it's subjective, and I think there is maybe no single person who would say Canada doesn't exist, which makes Canada universal. But there are countries in this world that are not universally recognized, and this is where we can argue if this name or country exists or not.
But there can be, and obviously there can be kind of other kinds of, I mean, any concept can be challenged on these, any concept with a name can be challenged on these grounds, right? Like, gender, for example, can be challenged on these grounds, like, well, what do you mean by that? And as soon as you can ask, what do you mean by that? There's a kind of something's being separated from being merely in a natural universal state, right? As soon as you can ask, what do you mean by that? This complication is just inevitably there in the way we think about what exists and what doesn't.
Exactly. And the question is not for me, what exists and what not exists. The question is, why do we need this concept at all in our language? And my answer is, well, we need this concept maybe somewhere to be used in the institutions to define rules or rituals. For example, if you take the example with the gender and sex, the question, why do we need sex? Because at least because there are some doctors that like just for men and just for women, and this is the reason we need sex. And we had rules like there is a men toilet or woman toilet, and this rule reproduces our need for this concept of sex. Or there are like language words like he or she that differentiate. So we create some legacy, downstream legacy concepts that keep the dependency on the initial concept in place and keep it reproducing. And then we say, well, the sex is one thing, but we say that we have a gender. And we say gender is equally important as the sex. And then we say, well, let's now introduce institutions based not on the sex but on the gender, because it is equally it has equal standing. It doesn't matter if you have physical chromosome or not. If you perceive yourself as a woman or a man, it has equal standing as if you have X or Y chromosome. So we started defining rules based on gender. And what happens next is, well, what if I identify today as a man, tomorrow as a woman, and the day after tomorrow as a coffee pot, which makes me some kind of unstable, and this renders all these rules as senseless, because institutions is something that needs to be stable. And this is, I think, a moment where we have to question, oh, does this institution make sense at all? And if this institution operates on some invented concepts, and both sex and gender are invented, we can actually ask ourselves, do we need those concepts? Why? If we don't have any, we just proven that these institutions doesn't make sense and these are the only usages of these concepts, do we need these concepts at all? And then we can maybe delete completely the gender and sex at all if we don't use them in any institution.
Yeah, this is obviously raising tons of very fascinating kind of questions. You reminded me of I was once in a seminar with the philosopher Richard Rorty, and it was very interesting. He got in this kind of argument with a kind of young graduate student who was in physics, I think. And what they were talking about, like making a statement, like Canada exists. And what I recall Richard Rorty saying was, it makes no sense to then to also say it is true that Canada, or there's no need to say it is true that Canada exists. I can just say Canada exists. And there was this, I remember this scientist, he was just like infuriated by this. No, it makes a difference to say, it is true that Canada exists, as opposed to just saying Canada exists, because
This is the in terms of the framework, it would be the one is ontological belief, another one is epistemological belief. And
exactly,
so for him it was clear border between two of them.
and it's also interesting though that on a certain level, and I think I'm bringing this up for a good reason, that there is a thinking person that is a part of this framework inevitably, and I think it was the from the scientist's point of view, it was like saying the important part of saying it is true is that I am co committing myself to this in a sense, but also I'm saying that it's true independently of me. That was what was so important to him, to say it is true that Canada exists, that it's independently of me. And but that's sort of very different from the framework where if we all forgot about it, or on another level, if all conscious beings in existence would cease to exist, I think most people would not object to the claim that Canada would no longer exist. Anyway,
I
I just
think
bring
what
that
you
up because it raises those questions of like there has in the framework that you're giving, there has to, for something to exist to an extent, there has to be a conscious thinking being engaging with it in
yeah,
some way.
a carrier of this this belief.
Yeah.
I think I'm not I don't never never studied philosophy, but I think there is a this concept modernism and postmodernism. The modernism was about splitting things that are really real, what you said, that exist independent on our beliefs, that are like my phone exists, and there are purely constructed things like Germany, and they were trying to split the world into real and constructed things. And the movement that came after them, the postmodernism, they were like, ah, guys, everything is constructed, so let's don't even try.
Yeah,
But
there's, I
maybe
mean,
I'm wrong.
well, no, you ca I think you capture the spirit of it. I mean, to be specific about it, postmodernism began as an architectural movement. But you captured the spirit of the thing, which this is kind of a little bit of an idiosyncrasy of mine, but the real key flip there was existentialism. And so if you read kind of Sartre and Camus and stuff like that, but going back to Kierkegaard and stuff like that, the idea that was really fundamentally introduced as it's inescapably a matter of personal will and action and responsibility, everything that we engage with. And so, from the existentialist point of view, there's this concept called bad faith, which is relating the things that I'm responsible for. And there's the term responsible is doing a lot of work there, but relating to things that I'm responsible for as though I'm not responsible for them. And so, when you see people clutching to the idea that something really exists, that is in fact inevitably some kind of construct, that's bad faith, right? Like, no, this is, it's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve or whatever, like when, no, it really is this way. There really is one way that things are, and it exists independently of our action and will and thought and belief. That's where that split. And again, my idiosyncratic kind of way of looking, that's really where that comes from. And that's the human divide and the way we approach the world, right? Like, there's, and that's one of the reasons I think I probably intuitively brought up revolution and the switch from monarchy to democracy. It's like, what happened to the Democrats was they were like, that's just a man. He can give whatever order he wants, that king, and it doesn't mean anything if we don't choose to follow. And so once you and but then there are other people who'd be like, no, that's the king. What are you talking about? You know, there's no, you can't just declare that the king isn't a king. You can't do it. Who are you to do that? And of course, that's what the existentialist collapse down to, like, but inevitably it is you. You're the one person that you are. You're engaging with the world, and you can just choose to not relate to that king as a king at all. Power structures might force you to one way or another, but inside, internally, you can just relate to anything you want, however you want. And that's kind of when a lot of people get very disturbed around when they hear about the concept they might have in their postmodernism, their sense of disturbance about that is exactly what the existentialist would zero in on as bad faith and fleeing, a form of fleeing and retreat from the responsibility that you actually have. So basically, it's a form of like aggressive cowardice.
Oh, okay. But basically, back to your example with a king, I think it's very well aligned with the ideas of the book that the power is not a property of a person, it's not a possession of a person or of an actant, it is a property of an arrangement. The king's power emerged because there are certain rules and beliefs around them, and everyone, even a slave, is connected to this arrangement. And I think it goes to your argument that even so we cannot control some things later on, but we have some things in our immediate arrangement, some nodes that we can reach, and this makes us responsible, not maybe for the entire outcome, but for part of it.
Yes, definitely. I mean, the kind of like one extreme version of it is Camus in The Myth of Sisyphus, I think, essentially addressing the question, since you can kill yourself every moment and every that you're alive, you're responsible for, and in a certain level, even with respect to the things that happen to you, because you could choose to end it all. And so even the things that with respect to which you are passive, you are playing and you have a kind of agency with respect to those things, because you could just check out. So it's just in the interest of time, this is a fascinating discussion, and I know we could talk a lot longer. And by the way, the book is just so good at explaining these things, and you can tell from, you know, the that there's a system behind it as well. And once you kind of trust, oh, this is going somewhere, et cetera, it's a very powerful book. But in the interest of time and in the interest of our audience, moving on to the last part of the interview where we talk about the author's experience as a writer. I was wondering what, and I mean this in a very kind of like concrete way. How did you write the book? Did you block off time in your calendar? Were you a kind of, when I'm traveling, when I'm like, I go to a cafe, do you go into a study or an office, things like that? Because I think when people are kind of, I know when people are starting out thinking, I want to write a book, they're like, but how do I do it?
I think there are many things that affect my book writing, but first of all, I consider writing itself like writing a code, because before you write a code, there are maybe 2 years of work of research, and just writing code is a list problem. I spent a lot of time before I started writing the book by researching and iterating the concepts. And after the power loop emerged as a stable concept, I started working on a book. Before power loop, I had 1 or 2 years just similar constructs. My goal from the beginning was to explain power in just one model, and it took me dozens of iterations to get there. But once the power loop emerged, I started writing, without real structure. I basically used writing to verify the ideas, because when you write and you see, ah, it doesn't fit, then you go back and start thinking again. And there was a lot of cases where I was already at 60, 70% of being finished, and then I reverted back to the first and second chapter because I needed to rethink everything again. But right now I don't write a book at all. If I can say that, I try to build a knowledge system. According to the, I don't know how are you familiar with programming. We had 20 years ago or so a pattern called model controller view, which separates your basically idea from the representation. For example, we have an Excel table. There are some numbers. There are a model. The model exactly, and then we have pie chart or some another chart. There are views, and we have a controller that builds the view from the model. And I follow the same approach. The book is just one of the views. My website is another view. My LinkedIn posts are another view. If I would write articles, they're just another view. And the model is a set of concepts. And I mostly work on these concepts. And over time, I created a lot of translation skills that translate those concepts to multiple views. For example, today, if I work on a tactic, right now I'm working on the tactics for the agendas. I create it in the model, and then I have very good trained skills that translate it for the website representation in terms of content and structure and layout, and to the book. And then I just review the views, the outcomes, and feed the result back into the model. But this, I started using this approach already after the model stabilized, because earlier I needed really to write the book linearly to test the concepts. Now, when the frame is set, I just bring new notes and translate them into different views. And I can do it. My problem is that I have work, I have three nonprofit organizations, I have three kids, I never have time. But I have like 10 minutes there, 10 minutes there, and 10 minutes there. This is I needed a system that would work in such environment. It's just
Right.
without 4 times, 4 hours of blocked focus time. I don't have this. And by this approach, by splitting the model from the view, I can change some small thing in the model. I don't need much time for it, and then let things translate into the views. And in another 10 minutes, I would review one of those views, and this helps me survive and succeed with the book.
That's a fascinating story of a book coming to existence and then what it became. I mean, it's sort of, I just love the idea of like the organically grew into a structure, but once it's a structure, it's something different than it is when it's the growing organism. I love also the idea of like it had under facing the fact that it has to fit into the your life and the way you're living it. The creative project that you're engaged in is actually something I think that's like kind of that's a very deep insight that a lot of us don't have when we're often conceiving how we're going to be doing things, that it must one way, whether that means I need to change my life or something like that, but a project needs to live within the framework that you're living yourself.
Yeah, it was a necessity. I would love to sit 8 hours a day and just write a book, but I don't have this possibility.
Well, not yet. But let's see. Yevgen, thank you so much for taking the time to do this interview with me today for the Lean Pub podcast. The book is The Architecture of Power. See what shapes outcomes, find where you can act. And I'm just so actually glad to learn that this is the kind of the begin or the middle, or I guess, or of a wider project. The book is fascinating. The way, the description you gave of how the kind of like narrative tactics or things map on to the five belief sort of dimensions was just amazing. And the rest of the book I know is full of things like that to find. So I highly recommend it to anyone who's interested in, I mean, definitely in, how companies really work, how projects work and how you can affect change within them. So thank you very much, Evgen, for being on this episode of the Lean Pub Podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Len, for having me. And it was an insightful discussion for me as well, because you brought so much interesting stuff that I didn't knew before.
Thanks.